Good morning. I'm actually privileged to lead the science board next year. And so it is, I see this as a responsibility to share with you not the process piece, but the meat, the content piece. I do this actually as somebody who, among other things, does policy on a day-to-day basis and have done so for almost 30 years. And so it's coming with perhaps a level of enthusiasm that you're not used to when it gets to policy. For many years on the Hill, there was a saying that policy making and sausage making are very much the same. Don't look at the process, it's usually messy, but if it's a good sausage, it tastes wonderful. So that should be the outcome. These are the learning objectives. You had them in the program, but what I'd like to do is kind of walk you through a roadmap of questions to ask in terms of the content and the quality of a policy. So it is like making sausage. It's messy. There are multiple recipes and multiple ingredients. The last-minute additions and deletions, we had such last-minute meeting as part of the late-breaker review. Too many cooks in the kitchen spoiled the dish. But good recipes are legendary, and those good recipes are, of course, I come from Louisiana. A good Louisiana Bowdoin sausage is, you can't match that anywhere. So here is the ABCs of policy and the relationship between science, policy, and practice. This is our good friend Larry Green, of course, his review and his framework for policy development. When you use that framework, it does a couple of things. One is you see that it is a bi-directional relationship between science, policy, and practice. Means that science drives both policy and drives good practice. At the same time, there is an upstream opportunity for policy to inform science and for practice to inform science. And in fact, it's that same upstream opportunity to fill the scientific gap with advocacy. And so advocacy plays an important role identifying gaps in science that we then in turn fill and propose policy for. And one element of the work of the Science Board this coming year will be to work with those that are advocating to find those gaps in science and fill those. So how do we frame a policy? And I, as you know, I've done a number, developed a number of national policies, so I come from that perspective, and some of this might be useful to you. So to develop a public health policy, you want to ask yourself a few questions. The first is, are we addressing a new threat, a new issue, something that hasn't been a public health issue before, or is it a Me Too policy? Are we addressing not only the policies that we advocate, but are we aware of adversaries to that policy, and how do we make that a win-win situation? Is the policy only stick-oriented, so it's its punishment, versus is there a carrot? Good policies have both sticks and carrots. Is the policy only about people, but does it also, in the case of the oil spill, involve pelicans or animals? And so how do we integrate that what is broader in terms of beyond individual health and to broader well-being? This is Webster's definition of a policy, but this, here is also where things go wrong. So it's a definite course, beginning with definite. It's not wishy-washy, it's definite. It's a definite course or method of action, selected from among alternatives. And so I always use the going to war in Iraq as an example of bad policy because there was no alternative. So a good policy always has alternatives. In light of conditions that guide not only present, but future direction. And so those are the ingredients of a good policy. Here's an example for an opportunity for policy where things get complex. And so if you look at what happens, for example, on the Gulf Coast, we have an existing burden of health disparities. consistent environmental health threats and hurricanes that are there. It is at that intersect of vulnerability that there is an opportunity for policy development. So how do you make the case? What is a stepwise approach to policy development? Make the case. Make the case in terms of what's its significance? What's the public health relevance? How do you approach that policy? How will it work? What's the environment, the context in which that policy will have to operate? And is it anything new? Are we doing anything different? So I'm going to take these each at a time. Making the case from a scientific perspective, actually there is precedence to do that, and it's difficult, but it is precedence in the public health world. And that is the Task Force for Preventive Services actually had laid out four basic questions. The first one is, should something be done? Identifying and justifying the basis and the burden of an issue, the burden of a problem, the burden of a disease, obesity, for example, is a good example. It's a good example of that. And so establishing the burden that really we have a problem, and doing that as much as possible in a quantitative fashion. Secondly, what should be done? What is it, based on that burden, that should happen? So what's the meat that the policy is asking, is calling for? Third, and I believe the most important and the most difficult of the four questions, is how should it be done? How do we propose that policy get into action? It's not very difficult to say we should do A, B, and C, but how really should it be done in order to make a difference? And then the last question is it really working? How do we know, how do we propose ahead of time, and Elaine Altus in the room, she would support that. How do you propose ahead of time the evaluation metrics that will make sure we know this is working? And then we want to look at, if we indeed implement this policy, will it be effective? Will it achieve what we wanted to do in the first place? And then lastly, what's the return on investment if we implement that policy? So significance. What will the new policy address that is not being addressed currently? And I take perhaps somewhat of a little different stand in terms of existing policies. There may be instances, indeed, where even if a policy exists, it may not be addressing a new threat or a new problem. And so just because a policy exists may not mean that we need to ignore or not consider a new policy. Secondly, public health relevance. So what if the new policy is implemented? How will public health benefit? And approach, we talked about that. How will the new policy be implemented? And is it really feasible in the context that where we want to implement it, in the context of our environment? And what's new in terms of innovation? So there are truly, in a way, four conditions within which new policy is proposed. The first one is rigidity, meaning that current policy will not resolve the public health issue at hand. Secondly, paucity. There's new credible scientific evidence that was not taken into account either in an existing policy or a policy that did not exist. Thirdly, complexity, and I'll give you an example of complexity towards the end. The adverse health consequences are beyond just human health, but do affect well-being in general, and the theme of this conference, social justice, gives a sense of that general well-being. Last but not least, sustainability. Is there an evaluation plan to look at whether we achieved what we wanted to achieve? This is a model that I use very often when I teach in terms of policy. This is how policy is developed, right? There's pressure, some action occurs, some change occurs, and then what often is forgotten is that last one of monitoring. If you don't monitor that the action stays in place, that is sustained, actually like the old days of the Pac-Man video game that your kids used to play, if you have older kids now, the arrows get reversed and the policy is eaten up. There are a number of wonderful resources, and Lynn mentioned that this is one of them from Geraldine Perry, and so if you'd like additional resources to look at. So here's an example of a complex issue that requires policy. For better or worse, I'm very involved currently with dealing with the public health implications of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And so a big policy issue is currently to drill or not to drill. Are we allowed to shoot states as Louisiana, continue to drill or not drill for oil? So from a policy perspective, then we ask, is the policy adequate? The policies that are in place, are they adequate? Is there something lacking? Or if they are in place and they're adequate, are they being enforced? So let's look what policies exist. Here are the major national policies that guide all drilling. Clean Water Act, Oil Pollution Act, RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and CERCLA. And so let's look at what's in those regulations. If you look at the Clean Water Act, there indeed is a maximum penalty of $110,000 or $3,300 per barrel or unit if there is a Clean Water Act violation, and clearly there was. There was a revision of the policy, and I'll give you an example of a revision that doesn't, that is a Me Too policy. So this is one of them. The price went up, the penalty, the stick, went up from $110,000 to $130,000. Is it meaningful? Does anything change? No, really. The Oil Pollution Act calls for spill prevention requirements and reporting obligations and response planning. And it's particularly calls, Section 311 particularly calls for effective and immediate action and immediate removal of the discharge. Well, we all know that did not happen. Like Katrina, it did not happen. The both Clean Water Act and Oil Pollution Act, in terms of liability, say that the environment includes fish, shellfish, wildlife, public and private property, shores and beaches, and all of those were affected. If you read the New York Times article a couple of days ago, we have lost coral reef. And so, yes, this should be enforced, right? But most of the time, legislation is not made because of science, because of power or greed or even altruism. It comes about because of fear. The Patriot Act is an excellent example of that. So in the case of to drill or not to drill, yes, there is new policy needed despite having all those policies in the book, because in all of those policies, from an environmental health perspective, the traditional way to do risk assessments is not going to help us there. The traditional way to do risk assessments is having as the standard human being the 70-kilo male. So I'm neither 70 kilos nor am I male, so that wouldn't apply to me and many of you in the room. We don't know much about the mixture of contaminants that was part of the crude oil as well as the dispersants, and so there is paucity of information and new science is needed. It's very complex because people, our communities, not only eat the fish because, sell the fish, but it's also subsistence fishing. And it is about sustainability to make sure that Gulf Coast communities can build or rebuild. So I want to leave you with that example, but also share with you that the Science Board has embarked on a series of actions to embed the science within sections, picks, and caucuses of how to develop policies. And one specific action will be to develop a network of mentors, of policy mentors, within the sections that can help with that development before policies are submitted to the Science Board. And so I'm looking forward to have further dialogue on that. Thank you.